Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today. Hello and welcome to a special edition of History Hack. If you don't live under a rock, you will have realised that it's the 31st of July today. Lockie, why is that an important date?
Oh, all sorts of reasons, but primarily, as far as we're concerned, it's the anniversary of the opening of one of those battles that you've heard of. If you've heard of maybe two battles in the First World War, you'll have heard of the Somme and you'll have heard of the Third Ypres Campaign, sometimes known as the Passchendaele Offensive. And that's what we're talking about today. A few of us in the house, how's it going, Holmes?
Not too bad. I think we need to be mindful of certain types of people get very offended referring to the 30 as the Battle of Passchendaele. So we need to be mindful of that while we proceed.
Yeah.
Okay, so we shouldn't say the Battle of Passchendaele then?
Well, only when you get to the Battles of Passchendaele bit, then I think we can say it, but let's not... I mean, I don't care personally, but I know there are people out there that, you know, are irked by these things.
They do, but they're also the same kind of people that are perhaps irked by the number of buttons on a tunic and a television adaptation. But okay, well, let's pay tribute to these guys. Beth's here as well. Hey, Beth.
Hey, Alex. You know, yeah, looking forward to this one as always. We like to be in our wheelhouse, don't we? So
we do. You've got four dedicated war boars in the room who are going to talk you through what happened in this battle. Because it's a long battle, isn't it? Let's go to Lockie first. Because Lockie, talk to us about the fact that it started in summer. Why it happened? Are you going to cover that for us?
Let's do that.
So you get us rolling, and then I'll take over when it starts raining.
sing that Eurythmics song. We've got the battle that I think our commander in chief almost always wanted to have. Really, with Third Ypres, Commander in Chief Sir Douglas Haig always wanted to be fighting in Flanders. I mean, the battle itself has got some things in common with the Somme. I know I mentioned the Somme. It's a big offensive with a big bombardment and absolutely not a hint of surprise about it. It's pretty obvious that this action was going to be fought because actually there's quite a lot to be gained by it. Even kind of the war cabinet having meetings the previous year was saying things like clearing the Belgian coast is absolutely our top priority, and especially so when we get into 1917, and that's the year we're talking about, because the Germans had restarted their unrestricted submarine warfare business, and it was really worrying. They were sinking a lot of ships. All right, there's other consequences as well. They're going to bring the Americans into it. But crucially for Britain, stopping this process of ships being sunk was a very real thing. Haig himself was, if not optimistic of a total breakthrough, then he thought it was possible. And if nothing else, he was going to fight the Germans on a ground that they would not fall back from. They were not going to refuse to fight here. And so with short logistics chains, this is a chance to really smack them hard. It's not just a case of driving through and breaking through, though. There's a chance to interrupt German logistics. There's a big railway junction really not too far away from where the front lines were, and the feeling was if you could capture that at Roussillara, or Roule as it was known, if you're going to do the French pronunciation, then you could effectively cut the German army off there and cut off their submarine ports as well, and possibly have them rolling backwards. So there's real gains to be had, strategic gains, and maybe a flank to turn as well. You never know. Now, Haig's plans for this were big when they were first kind of mooted, kind of beginning of 1916. He's also planning the Somme, that kind of time, and his plan was if there was breakthrough on the Somme, they immediately unleash Second Army through Flanders, and that didn't happen. But plans were being made, and they ended up not quite being what Haig wanted. Cooperation with the French was always going to be part of it. Britain in the lead, though, because you know we're close to Britain there. Who's going to command is one of these controversies about it. Now, when we get into 1917, the controversy essentially, and what people tend to say is that the man who was commanding the British Army in that area is a man called Herbert Plumer, very methodical, very competent indeed, and it should have been his baby right from the start. Haig didn't do that. Haig picked another man.
He had proved himself just a few weeks before in the preliminaries for this offensive as well, hadn't he?
He had, but he hadn't before that. And Haig made the decision before Messines Ridge. Yeah, Messines Ridge happened in June of 1917, so yeah, nearly 2 months before. But actually, Haig had decided that a man called Hubert Gough was gonna be in charge of this offensive at the end of April.
But for the reasons that, like, Messines, for people who don't know, is regarded as one of the most successful British actions of the First World War, isn't it?
Well, it was. It was this position that dominated the landscape to the south of Ypres since the Germans had took it off the British and French in 1914. And it's a significant lump, for sure, where in a place where there aren't very many significant lumps. And so actually Plumer's plan and execution and capturing Messines Ridge was a pretty impressive thing. I think we can go overboard with the Messines Ridge capture because it was blown to bits. You know, it wasn't a simple thing. This was an incredibly expensive and difficult operation involving huge mines, massive artillery bombardments that splattered the ground so much that it couldn't be moved over quickly.
Yeah, and also not cheap in terms of manpower, what it cost to take it either.
No, indeed not. And that's the kind of, the initial assault was well, I would say easily done, but fairly cheap in terms of casualties. But any attempt to try and press on and actually really kind of take the ground, which made the ridge secure, or even get to the German gun line, that's when it started being costly.
We ended up guys all along the top of the ridge getting shelled, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And Plumer had, well, if not failed, then he certainly struggled through 1916 in the salient area. They'd lost the Bluff, which is pretty much the only bit of high ground that the British really held, struggled around St. Elwar, around the craters over there as well. And so Plumer wasn't exactly flavour of the month kind of in early 1917, whereas Hubert Gough was.
Peter Hart loves to tell everybody, I think because he just likes using the word, Gough is a thruster.
Peterkins.
Yeah.
Well, no, and actually, you know, in terms of what the British Army had achieved so far, Gough was probably the highest performing army commander because his Fifth Army had taken the most valuable positions on the Somme battlefield. When combat had resumed in early 1917, it was his army that had driven the Germans back away from the Somme altogether and then led the pursuit to the Hindenburg line as well. It was his divisions that were the top performing ones, which were actually setting the benchmark for what kind of the attack templates and the way British Army formations would be trained. And so Gough really was the top man at that time. All right, things didn't quite work out perfectly at Bull Corps, but you know, it's still he's very much and he's also the youngest of the army commanders. He's energetic, you know, he's a full 12-13 years younger than Plumer as well, and the feeling is for the breakout, which Haig hoped would happen at least, then that Gough was the man. Now in terms of the preparation for the offensive, I would kind of want to say that this is almost the pinnacle of 1916 style fighting, because what you've got is huge amounts of artillery. You know, where we talk about the destructive bombardment launched for the Battle of the Somme, we're talking about 1.7 million cannon shells fired in the space of a week. Third Ypres doubles that. They increase the number of
stacks behind each other, aren't they? Some of the guns firing over the top of the guns in front, like wheel to wheel.
Absolutely, yeah. And so it's a hugely destructive bombardment that they fire. They're aiming for high ground again, all right? They've captured the high ground at Messines Ridge, which is to the south of Ypres. But actually, if they're going to get to that rail junction at Roulet, then they need to capture the high ground to the east of Ypres, Gellivelt Plateau, rising up towards Passchendaele Ridge, all right? Capture all of that, and then it's pure flat ground. Away to Roulet, and then that's the prize, isn't it? The rail junction. A few miles to go to capture that high ground, and so you're not going to do it in a day, very likely. So they batter the German first and second lines in particular, and then make plans for an advance thereafter. The plan was still to have French support, and they did support, although they were a little bit cagey on that, the French, and with just over a month ago, the French were almost saying, look, we're not with you on this. They're still kind of piecing their army back together after the Nivelle offensive, and let's maybe not get started on Nivelle because
they were really hoping the war would be over by this point, were they? Because they believed his stupid posturing about being able to finish it in a couple of days. That's the Nivelle story in a nutshell, and it failed because he was silly. France are still fighting a war, and they're not.
Yeah, and it did complicate things for Third Ypres as well, because with the Nivelle offensive failing, Haig had to restart the Arras offensive to try and hold Germans in place to the south, which meant that he couldn't move enough troops up early on to Flanders. And there's a knock-on effect, which complicates things. And actually, quite a few of these units involved on the 31st July 1917 have fought at Arras as well, and are still putting themselves back together from that, which is a shame. But units like 51st Division, for example, are in that bracket. No chance of sneakiness. The Germans knew an attack was coming in that area. It was pretty predictable. And so when we get to the time of the assault, well, there's a lot of counter-battery firing. The Germans have got their artillery in place. They've moved in 10 fresh divisions. They've got loads of guns spare. So this is really going to be both sides throwing the kitchen sink at each other in Flanders. Germans not going to give an inch. Britain definitely looking to bust through. And so we have what, 9 divisions throw themselves over the top with a bit of support from a couple of other divisions as well on at sunrise on the 31st of July. And
that's how it went.
Yeah, well, on the whole, if I summarise it quickly, not too bad.
Start at the top. The top, great. Really good.
Yeah. So the far kind of left flank of the British Army, adjoining the French, is the Guards Division.
All my old Etonians.
Yeah, red uniforms and bearskin hats.
Yeah.
No, not quite, but...
No, exactly those outfits. No, they weren't. And then next to them, you've got the poor Welsh Division, which have finally been stuck back together after Mamet's Wood on the Somme.
Yeah, but this is actually an important kind of bit of ground for the Welsh as well, because you do have 38th Welsh Division, and they happen to be attacking alongside the battalion of the Welsh Guards, in the Guards Division as well. And there's Victoria Crosses up there. And although, the Guards fight brilliantly, actually. I'm going to take nothing away from the Guards. They managed to get across the canal a couple of days that runs.
That's the thing. So the Yser Canal was supposed to be a nightmare, and they had made crossing pads and they had trained and everything. And then a couple of days before, the Germans just buggered off from the canal.
From the canal bank, so the Guards hopped over the other side, and there was a bit of a worry that their kind of supporting units might be cut off, but they bodged these bridges with matting and all sorts of stuff, and they managed to get going very much on time. The Guards stuck to their creeping barrage, their protective. But this is the thing: the artillery fires ahead of the soldiers, and the attacking troops follow up to it as closely as they can. Point being that the Germans don't have time to get out and man their machine guns before the infantry are on top of them. And this worked really well for the Guards. For 38th Welsh Division, they almost lost it. There's a couple of points where it seems to be getting away from them, and you've got some company commanders who drive their men on hard and manage to keep up to it just about, going in short rushes. But these two divisions managed an advance of 1,800 yards or so and captured Pilkem Village. Really, really good. Next corps down, Ivor Maxey's 18 Corps, 51st Highland Division, met some pretty stiff resistance, actually. Didn't quite get across the river, which was their target, until sort of later in the day. The Steenbeek was a muddy little ditch, really, but it was an obstacle. They did take quite a few prisoners moving through the outpost zone, though, and made some decent progress, as did 39th Division to their south, and they occupied St. Julian Village. They were helped out by tanks. There were a few tanks on the battlefield. You see them kind of piecemeal, like two tanks going forward and maybe covering the infantry or squashing some barbed wire. And that certainly happened in the case of 39th Division. Moving further south, 55th Division also had a couple of tanks in support, got a foothold east of that muddy ditch, the Steenbeek, and captured a couple of farms with some prisoners as well. There's a really famous man involved in this, actually, Noel Shabbas, People would have heard of him, I'm sure. He's the man in the First World War who was awarded a Victoria Cross and Bar. This is his and Bar action, his second Victoria Cross. I've got his citation here, actually. For most conspicuous bravery and devotion to duty when in action, he was medical officer. For the Liverpool Scottish, of course. Though severely wounded early in the action whilst carrying a wounded soldier to the dressing station, Captain Chavasse refused to leave his post and for 2 days not only continued to perform his duties, but in addition went out repeatedly under heavy fire to search for and attend to the wounded who were lying out. During these searches, although practically without food during this period, worn with fatigue and faint with his wound, he assisted to carry in a number of badly wounded men over heavy and difficult ground. By his extraordinary energy and inspiring example, he was instrumental in rescuing many wounded who would otherwise undoubtedly have succumbed under the bad weather conditions. This devoted and gallant officer subsequently died of his wounds. So real bravery being shown throughout. 15th Division to their south made some decent progress, got rid of a nasty strong point in Frazenburg, again with the help of some tanks. And then it starts getting muddier because we're on the sort of southern end of 5th Army's actions here. And you've got some great units. I know we've done a podcast about the Somme and talked about 30th and 18th Division. They're pretty much the only divisions that did really well on the opening day of the Somme. They're down here. They've got really, really tough tasks. And their task is to capture the high ground at Gellievelt. Now, they do manage to get onto it. They bite the nose off the high ground, do make some really tough progress. But because it's so valuable, of course, the Germans know it's valuable as well. So they concentrate artillery onto it. And there are really very heavy casualties there. So progress slim, but some progress still. Now, if you compare this, there's counterattacks that follow, but essentially the gains largely get held onto. If you compare this day and the kind of days that follow with the opening day of the Somme offensive, you've got to say this is not too bad, actually. This is, you know, we're talking about broadly an advance of around about 3,000 yards across the front. Some valuable ground taken, certainly Pilcombe is on a slight rise, and that's pretty valuable, but also getting up onto the edge of the Gellievelt Plateau, pretty valuable as well. Casualties, much, much slighter than the Somme. We're talking about 30,000 or so British casualties, and at least that many German casualties, of which about 6,000 were prisoners. They managed to get about 6,000 Germans back through the cages. So on the whole, we're not talking about a disastrous day. Really, really tough, horrible, kind of hard series of days of fighting, but it's a horrible war.
Yeah. And yet, the Guards are the only ones ostensibly that have got pretty much, they've got four coloured lines, all of them, to achieve, and the red line is the last one, and the only ones to sort of get near the red line are the Guards. You mentioned the high ground at Gellievelt, which is the Gellievelt Plateau, and this is going to become the sticking point for like the next 20 minutes probably, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's so valuable. It's the kind of, it's the southern edge of this high ground that which runs off to the east of Ypres, and without getting up to Gellievelt, you ain't going to get Passchendaele, you ain't going to get the ridge line, and so without it's nothing.
And the issue here, you can just finish off this bit, take us to like the 4th of August. The issue is it starts pissing with rain, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's actually not uncommon. I mean, the part that, you know, Haig's really concerned in July when the, you know, Gough and the French army commander are both saying, oh, we need to delay, we're not quite ready. Well, actually, there's a history of pissing rain in August in Flanders. You know, early summer, you'll get a bit of rain. Haig knows it. He's dead worried about it. And so he wants everyone to get a move on. But he can't. So he ends up with delays and a later start than he wanted. And then, sure enough, on cue, the weather.
I'll take over for a bit. I'm not going to dwell too much on this. I don't know if you guys agree. I hope Holmes does, because we wrote a book together on this, and this is what I said in both our names. I kind of split this battle into three sections. You've got the beginning, which is kind of like a sensible, if not very sad and costly, attempt to win the war in 1917. You've got then, because as I'm about to explain, it all goes wrong. Then you've got the bunny hops in the middle, and then you've got the complete shit show, which finishes it off. And so to take us to the end of the first section, you have it, and this is already descending into farce a bit, isn't it, guys? Because you have this awful weather and the ground not drying out. So you get this fall of rain that sort of goes. So the initial throws of this battle go up to the 4th of August, or that's where we put them. We kind of like the first couple of days while they're sort of settling down again and digging in and figuring out what they're going to do next. And it just rains and rains and rains. And actually, Haig warns Goth to be patient and wait for just 2 to 3 days of good weather to dry the ground out a bit before you try go forward again. We've used the word thruster. He's a thrusting general and he doesn't listen. He's not really interested. He doesn't do caution, Goth, does he? And sometimes that's great. And I guess when you're picking a guy to lead this offensive, you're like, boom, yeah, that's our man. He ain't going to say no, but perhaps he should have done. So what he does is rather like we talked about, didn't we, with the someone, about the fact that you then have to decide whether you go, you keep pushing at where you've been successful, so which in this instance is up near the French and the Guard and the Welsh, or whether you try and niggle away at the stuff that's gone wrong. They kind of mess around at West Howick and Langmark, don't they? Which are two sticking points that haven't gone according to plan. And they do this in atrocious weather and really in a piecemeal way. August in this battle really gets on my nerves because I don't see, I don't know if you got, guys, tell me if you agree. I don't see how Goth thought this was ever going to work in August.
Well, no, you've got these streams that run across the battlefield. And as soon as you shell an area of ground heavily, as they clearly had done, you shatter the water courses around there. And it doesn't need to be a huge amount of rain necessarily, because the natural flow of the stream is just gonna flood the ground, and we can get all geological.
But you mentioned the Steenbeck. I mean, this is basically exploded at the time of this battle because it's full of water and the ground is messed up and it can't drain.
And also, they're sort of. They're a cross between streams and a very small river as well. They're not streams as we would imagine, you know, a couple of foot high, a few inches deep. They are some places two metres or so wide and quite deep.
And you're also, Holmes, I was just going to say as well, the fact that you have to remember that this ground is basically like sea level or under already.
Well, also, I know Lockie just mentioned about the fact that, you know, they've been smashed up, but as... Professor Peter Dorn, who I understand is a great friend of the show, as he always points out as well, that the soil in Flanders is clay as well at that bit, so that the drainage with that on its own is going to cause problems.
Yeah, so they go bashing away into August, and it doesn't go well, and Haig loses it with Goth and thinks, I can't go on like this. So essentially, one thing we haven't mentioned, because it's boring, and because we on behalf of all of us, don't like Lord George, is the fact that the government had decided, hadn't they, that, does anyone want to challenge that? Does anyone want to say they're a fan?
No, carry on.
Right, brilliant. So what they've done, the government, is said, well, we're not having a repeat of the Somme. We're not having that. So we're going to reserve the right. At any point, if this offensive looks like it's not going to plan, or if it's like it's wasting lives, the government reserve the right to cut it off and make you stop. And then they promptly all go on holiday and do nothing while this is playing out, which they have to take some responsibility for, as far as I'm concerned, because they do nothing in the course of the next 3 months. So August sort of transpires into this complete mess. And one person I did want to mention, because Holmes and I did do a book on this with Johnny Dyer as well, and one person that really got our attention and who gets a lot of visitors actually is Arthur Conway Young, isn't it? And this is because, and the other two as tour guides will know this, because I bet they've pointed him out to lots and lots of people. And it's because his family chose, and it's a very rare, is it the only instance of an anti-war sentiment on a Commonwealth War Graves headstone?
I don't recall seeing many about.
No, so he's part of this. 16th of August is one of the last sort of large-scale stupid attempts to try and make progress in these awful conditions. And he's part of the Ulster Division, which is another division that's kind of been pieced back together after taking a really big hit on the Somme. They were at Teepvale on the opening day of the Somme and got nowhere. And he's killed in this. And his uncle wrote this letter, didn't he? And we quoted it, where he just said his nephew was lost to them. He wrote to the War Office and he said that he'd been told he died on or shortly after the 16th of August, 1917, in an abortive offensive, 2 days after he'd come out the trenches dead, tired and weary. He went on to condemn the circumstances, no doubt furnished by other officers in letters of condolence. And he said, no wonder things went wrong on that day. If the other men were in a similar condition, a fine reward for coming all the way to Japan to fight for the old country. His father was a newspaper editor there, and that's what he did. He sailed home to join the army. And his headstone actually says, sacrifice to the fallacy that war can end war, which is exactly on a much more philosophical level, exactly what World War One was supposed to be. So August, a mess, and Haig calls time on Gough, and he goes for Plumer instead, doesn't he? He decides Plumer's more measured, slower attempt, and the way he operates is more likely to chip away gradually at the Gelleveld Plateau than just continually slamming men into a nightmare. So he makes the switch. This is phase two of the battle starting now, and Holmes is going to take us on now, because I call them, and I've even done a cartoon version of Plumer with ears and a fluffy tail. I call it his bunny hops, because that's essentially what he's going to do, isn't it, Holmes?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Gough had sought big results over a broad front, whereas Plumer intended to launch a series of more focused, smaller offensives, each across a narrower front. The depth of the objectives would be shorter than the previous attacks by Gough, as this would allow attackers to push forward quickly and consolidate gains by digging in, preparing defences sooner. One of the issues in the first phase that we just talked about was the ferocity and the success of the German counterattacks. The hope was, with this more focused approach, that it would give the attacking troops more time to dig in and consolidate their position. It also meant that the German counterattackers had much greater distance across the ground.
This is, isn't it? This is bite and hold. This is, instead of charging and trying to achieve everything at once, bite a little bit of your objective off, bring everybody up, set up again, make sure you've held it, and then bite again.
Yeah. So the objectives in the attacks have been reduced to those within a short distance of our line, as it was impossible for men to go forward over any long distance. And his object was to spare the troops to the utmost possible degree, whilst at the same time complying with the orders from GHQ. Now, the other advantage of this as well, when you were always within range of your artillery.
Yep.
You didn't have to move the artillery up. So the artillery could always provide covering fire. And Plumer realised the importance of artillery, so he increased the number of guns available. He pulled in large numbers of them from 7th Corps and the 3rd and the 4th Armies. And on the 20th of September, he had a total of 1,295 guns and howitzers, which would be positioned in front of the Gelleveld Plateau, with one gun for every 5 feet of front. And at this point, that was the largest collection of guns gathered in the war to date. As we've already mentioned, the capture of the Gelleveld Plateau was vital, so every resource was used to achieve this objective. To enable to plan as effectively as possible, Plumer asked for a three-week delay. During this time, planks were put down to make makeshift roads, and duckboard tracks were laid everywhere to assist in the movement of troops. Railways were also extended, and also he laid deep-lying telephone lines, which is something Gough never bothered to do during the first phase of this. He also made sure that all the guns were positioned correctly, and they had necessary gun pits and on platforms, etc.
So to tell people, the deep-lying telephone-wise is because the instant artillery start going at each other, if you've only got your telephone lines across the top, it's the age-old World War One issue in battle, isn't it, guys? Communications, because the shells hit your wires, your telephones are buggered, and nobody can talk to each other. As soon as the men are out of sight, you've got basically no idea what's going on beyond what you can get from runners and air observation. And they did try lots of different things, but it strikes me as slightly obvious to do the telephone wire thing before the offensive starts.
Yeah, Gough knew it as well.
Yeah.
No excuse, really.
I suppose the other difference with this one as well was the barrage that started before the attack. Instead of having a massive one that built up and built up and built up, this was quite subtle in that they got to work just targeting enemy batteries and strong points such as pillboxes and machine gun nests. So it looked like they were just carrying out routine artillery strikes rather than building up to something that was going to signal an offensive.
And yet, this is the beginning of this targeted stuff is what's going to win the war in 18, isn't it? It's going to by destroying, literally hunting down and destroying as many artillery batteries as you can of the enemies is going to make your life easier, and it's what's going to help the Allies advance to victory. So although it's like, it's kind of two-pronged at this time, they're still feeling their way around, aren't they?
Well, they still need observed fire. That's the one thing. They do need registration. They're working towards, they're getting close to that kind of dark art of, you know, getting your accurate maps and topography and decent compass bearings or whatever bearings you're using, plus, you know, meteorological conditions and all this other stuff. All
the sound raging stuff's coming
yeah,
in.
Yeah, wear of the gun barrels, you know, uniformity of shell size, all those kind of things that will affect your artillery accuracy. And, you know, by the end of the year, they can, you know, without firing any registration shots, they can, you know, hit a, you know, or get close to hitting a strong point from a few miles away, just with predictive fire. But they're not there yet, so they do still need to do some ranging.
Yep.
So the first of Pluma's battles was known as the Battle of, I don't know, I'd always known it as the Battle of the Menin Road, but now every time I've looked into it now, it's the Battle of the Menin Road Ridge, which sounds like something I've never heard of before.
No, me neither.
Battle's Nomenclature Committee, I think, is Menin Road Ridge.
Is it? Well, we can go with that tonight. But that was,
I'm gonna pull the official history now.
That was planned for the.
Nerd out while you carry on.
Battle was planned for the 20th of September, and on that day, actually, they had twice as many guns as the 31st of July over half the front, and they had twice as many troops over half the front as well. So you can see, Blumer is trying to massively focus his resources over a much shorter area, which that hope that it would lead to success. So the attack was going to take place across an 8-mile front. The direct attack on Gallipoli Plateau would be undertaken across a 4,000-yard front by the 41st and 23rd Divisions and the 1st and 2nd Australian Divisions. Key objectives were either side of the Menin Road, which ran east out of Eade and included Nonbosian Wood, Glencorse Wood, Inverness Copse, Polygon Wood, and the pillboxes that made up Tower Hamlet. For the first attack, Pluma was only intending for an initial advance of between 1,000 and 1,500 yards. He'd limited his intentions to the furthest distance calculated that his men could reach while still being protected by the artillery.
That doesn't sound like much. It sounds like common sense, but this is novel to go, I'm only going as far as the gun protection goes and not giving them anything else to go for. That hasn't been done regularly.
Well, also, they actually gave orders saying no matter what tactical opportunities show themselves, ignore them and dig in. Whereas I think when we were talking about Gough's fourth line, that was basically, if you hit all three of the first three lines, have a go at that if you want type of thing, wasn't it? So there's a complete difference to this approach here. And then, as we said earlier, by limiting the distance of each step, Pluma was hoping to avoid wastage of the previous few months. The artillery could continue to provide cover from their existing positions, and the German counterattack troops would have much more ground to cover, which would give the British much more time to dig in, and the Germans would be exposed to the British artillery barrage, which were already in position and knew where they were aiming. I guess the other thing to point out by now is that the weather had improved. It stopped raining.
Yeah, we could benefit from that, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, in certain places, it was so dry now that it caused problems. Artillery observers, they had their view obscured by the smoke and dust on the battlefield. And in the build-up to this offensive, clouds of dust thrown up in the air by large numbers of troops moving around could give their positions away. But on the actual day of the attack, there was a slight bit of rain overnight, but the attack started at 5:40. After another massive artillery barrage that I think was even bigger than the one on the 31st. The advance progressed at 25 yards a minute. I think as well, by this time, if we go back to the Somme, the difference in how the infantry were told to act could be, we can highlight that as well.
Yeah.
Infantry now, rather than on the Somme, where they just got out of the trenches and walked in a big line or a series of lines.
Yeah, we do worms now, don't we?
Yeah, now they're in small platoons, and all the platoons, they're all specialists, so you had sort of rifle specialists, grenade specialists, rifle grenade specialists, and then machine gun carriers. And they were trying to move quickly, as you say, in a sort of snaking pattern between the shell holes, which is a big difference to what had gone before. He deliberately kept back 25% of troops in reserve, so he had something to fall back on should he need it.
Yeah, I think the important thing is, so the weather does improve and sort of tactical things have been learned, but Pluma's approach works. This is a success as far as World War One battles goes, isn't it?
Apart from anything else, in terms of inflicting loss on the Germans, it's great because their counterattacks have become so predictable by this stage. You know, the British attack, the Germans counterattack, with a bit of an artillery bombardment and trained counterattack troops. Well, all right, we take a small bite, as you say, they've got further to go, and then we absolutely pulverize it. That's the plan from that point. So German losses start climbing hugely.
Yeah, on the first day, the Germans launched 11 counterattacks. One had a minor effect that wasn't successful. The rest were all completely repulsed. So the first day was pretty much a success almost across the entire front. The Fifth Army advanced 1,000 yards across advanced 1,000 yards, and the Second Army 1,500. And we'd finally got a hold on the part of the Gulliver Plateau, which is the thing that had been eluding us all along.
So it worked. Does he get another 3 weeks to do this again?
No, that finished on the 20th. The Battle of Menin Road, or the Battle of Menin Road Ridge, whichever one we're going for, finished on the 25th of September, which was followed up on the 26th of September by the Battle of Polygon Wood.
Yeah, so so what you'll see with Plumer's Bunny Hops, because we'll go on to the third one with Beth in a minute, is that despite the fact that he proves that if you wait and prepare, he doesn't get the time to wait and prepare. The time comes down and down as he's doing them, doesn't it? So tell us about Polygon Wood.
Polygon Wood is similar, actually. I mean, if you look at the geography from it, it's not, the objectives aren't that far away from what they were in the Battle of Menin Road Bridge or Battle of Menin Road.
I never get this right, though. So they're now where they are on Gulliver Plateau after Menin Road Ridge. Are they basically where the first objective was on the opening day in July?
I don't know. That's what they hoped for.
Yeah.
But I mean, without going into too much, it was basically, although he didn't have much time to prepare, it was still another pretty much brilliant success.
And that's despite the fact that the Germans threw a spanner in the works in one sector, didn't they?
Wasn't that because they would just happen to be counterattacking at the same time, purely by coincidence?
So yeah. as the Australians, was it Australians? As the Australians kicked off in one part, they got up and found Germans coming at them because they were attacking at the same time. So even despite that, it is Australians, right? Am I just imagining this?
I think it is Australian. They both sort of ended up in no man's land and were quite surprised to see each other there, as far as I can remember.
Or is that Breedsend? Oh, I'm confusing myself now.
My bit.
That's my line. Don't steal it. But yeah, there are some clashes. There's a counterattack definitely on the 25th / 26th as they're starting this second bunny hop, but it doesn't impact them too much, does it?
No, not at all. But I mean, again, it's the same sort of thing. It was a small front. We were looking to only go, you know, capture a small part of the German line. And it was another success. Most of the key objectives were taken, including Polygon Wood. I think the thing to highlight in is, despite the success, there were quite a lot of British casualties. So in Polygon Wood, it was just over 15,000. I've got a feeling for Battle of Menin Road, it was 20,000. So they are a success, but they're not without a cost. But at the same time, I think as Lockie mentioned, I think they estimate that we took at least the equivalent amount in German casualties.
Okay, and then the weather goes again, but they decide to go with bunny hop number 3, which is where Beth comes in, even though we've just done like a massive spoiler.
So as been elaborated on already, you know, these bunny hops, the bite and hold, it is something that has proved successful. But as we've noted, the time that Plumer has to prepare, or that they have to prepare in that area, does get less and less. The third bunny hop is the Battle of Broodzinder, which is on the 4th of October 1917. Again, trying to take, you know, we're still working away at the Gulliver Plateau. We are intent on getting that plateau, because as has been mentioned, without having that plateau, without having the ridges surrounding Ypres, we cannot then take Passchendaele and then onto Roulers-Rousselet, onto the railway lines, those key important parts. We have to take that plateau before we can go any further. And as we've said, this is when the rain starts again. So where you think of, you know, when you see pictures of, and this is Passchendaele, this is Belgium, this is the First World War, mud, you know, up to your knees, and people sinking into the mud, you know, the famous pictures of like the horses falling, is so drowning into the mud. This is where it really starts to come into fruition, because not only at this point in time has the rein turned, they are now also fighting over territory that has been shelled for months and months and months. With the best of intentions, this is a ground that is completely churned up. It's, as we've mentioned, crisscrossed with streams, rivers that have completely lost their banks. There is no drainage in the area. This is a literal quagmire. This third bunny hop of Broodzinder was vital, as we said, to taking the plateau. And it is, again, another successful but use of the bite and hold. It starts from around the Polygon Wood area at its most southern part of the offensive, moves up around through Zonnebeck and towards the village of Passchendaele in the distance. If you are in that area, part of what is taken on the 4th of October by the Australians, one of the Australian divisions, 3rd Australian Division, is the set where Tynecott Cemetery and Memorial is now. So that attack is to, again, we're taking it in bites. We're going to work our way up this ridge, because if any of you have been to that area, you will know if you stand somewhere like Tynecott, right at the top of the cemetery, you can see for miles. That high ground it's such a vantage point. It's so important. And they need to work their way up this ridge so that they can have the best positions they have come the end of autumn into winter. So we've got a variety of different divisions attacking. We've got the 5th Division, 21st Division in the south, all the way around to the Anzac Corps. So all of the the 1st and 2nd and 3rd Australian Divisions fighting, and my true loves Dominion troops and New Zealanders, they're also fighting from the 4th of October as well. And their objectives were, as an average, somewhere about 1,000, 1,200 yards deep. Some went right up to over 2,000 yards for the objectives, but it is in these small chunks that can be managed. You've got the first objective, the red line, and you've got the final objective eventually, which is the blue line, which is 200 to 400 yards after the red line for most of these units. And it goes well. I mean, it's, you know, obviously it's far more complex than just saying, yeah, it went great, they did this, they did that. This, it's far more complex than that. It starts early in the morning, the offensive, as all of these offensives do. And it is at this time it's for the 5th Division as well. That's what Alex has already mentioned with my spoiler alert, that they do just happen, that the Germans were intending to launch their own counterattack on the 4th of October themselves. And they, by coincidence, happened to come across the 19th Reserve Division in no man's land, basically. And I think I can only imagine what that must have been like.
From what I heard, I remember, it was all misty and they were like, who are those guys? I don't know.
Who's that?
Going, who's that? I don't know. Is that us or is that them or what's happening?
Yeah, and I could just imagine some of the faces thinking, hang on, are those actually, you look at them like concentrating, is that really what I think it is? And then thinking, oh, bloody hell, you know, it's when they realise what's actually coming towards them.
I will say, if anyone wants to see one of the Germans, that one of them was treated by British medics when he was wounded coming across, and he's just up from Nelly Spindler. So if you are in Lysenhoek and you go left, face Nelly, and then walk to the left, there's a clump of German graves, and there's a chap called Richard Genshoff there that was treated because he was one of this lot that clashed with British troops at the beginning of this.
So, and that's, you know, always a good point to remember, isn't it? We're very good at saying, oh, the British, oh, the Australians, but, you know, there's those stories as well, isn't there, that we must not forget to tell as well. With this attack, you know, as I said, it is obviously like any attack in the First World War, it is not all sunshine and daisies, and it's a battle. It will be gruesome. It will be tough. For the majority of the divisions involved, the Australians, New Zealanders, 21st Division, 5th Division, they take almost all of their objectives, if not all of them. Some of them do take all of their objectives within the first couple of hours. You know, they've made their way up that the corner of that Gelleveld plateau, up towards the ridge, up towards what is the village of Passchendaele eventually. And they manage to get into their first line objectives, the red line, and hold those positions. The Germans do obviously counterattack. You know, that's they bring in the Eingraf divisions, who attack in number and in high concentration of force, and they manage to hold their positions. It is when you go into it in more depth, and obviously we don't have the necessary time really to go into the exact depth of what needs to be done for these battles. But, you know, we've got advances of, in some cases, most of them advance over 1,000 yards, some a bit under. So there are some divisions as well that managed to advance over almost double that, almost all the way to 2,000 yards. And that's particularly for 3rd Australian Division, who have made their way up through that, through where Tynecott Cemetery is now, obviously that key location, through all of those bunkers, the machine gun nests, the barbed wire, you know, those really strong defensive positions that the Germans have created for themselves. They make their way through them. Obviously, by this point as well, this is where, because the rain has again started, again, just reiteration of the fact that the ground that they are now advancing over is becoming increasingly difficult to follow behind. And from the 4th of October, the success of the 4th of October, the relative success, it's, you know, it's a good offensive for the British and the Australians, whatnot. It works well.
However,
but it changes
the end of section 2 of the battle, which is
it is stopping.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we now moved on. There is no other name for this. Section 3 of the battle, 3rd Battle of Ypres, is the October-November shit show, isn't it, Beth?
It is. And I mean, I can see why, as a layperson who has never been in the military, will not serve in the military, I can see why you would want to exploit your successes.
This is just like the Somme now. They've realised they will not end the war.
Yeah. It's got to the point where it's not going to happen.
So let's get the best positions for next year, which means at the moment that we're not in a great position because we're sort of midway across and we need to finish off for the year. That's the justification behind it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for some of the positions where they're sat, you know, like they're halfway up the ridge, the Passchendaele Ridge. Some of them are further back. As you say, it's not a comfortable position for them to be in. They've got to improve where they are. And it has to happen fairly quickly because, as we've said, we know the weather conditions, we know the ground type, winter's coming. If they didn't sort it then in October, they were going to still be there in February, March. So it had to happen. We're moving forward. They're not having the time to prepare for the coming battles. And the next battle that happens for the British is the Battle of Pol Capel, which is, again, slightly further along. So if you're looking at Ypres and you've got a map, Polygon Wood is about east-ish, and you move your way around to like northeast-ish, and again, slightly further more to like north-northeast is like around the area of where Pol Capel is. So we're
on the way to Roulers, which is what Lockie mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we're still in the same sort of area. We're not miles and miles away. It's always trying to improve the position. Obviously, what's happening is with the ground, obviously, as we're moving forward, you know, with these successes of Polygon Wood, Menin Road, Broodzinder, the artillery is having to move forwards to keep up so that they can continue to support with creeping barrages and so on. And because the ground has spent months and months being shelled, the water issues, as we've already mentioned, the issues of the ground is getting harder and harder for the artillery and any sort of supply chains and so on to keep up, to be able to carry on these battles, particularly as well, as we say, as the time frames are shortening. So we're looking at the Battle of Pol Capel on the 9th of October. We're well into now this period of awful rain. We are now firmly in autumn, but it is important to get those positions. And also as well, there is still a sense of there still do need to be some sort of fighting. There is still is an initiative to be had. When we know that, you know, later on, we've got the Battle of Cambrai in November as well, further south, and the French are fighting as well. Like we've got the Battle of La Malmaison in at the end of October as well. It is, the onus is on the Allies to keep the fighting going. The 9th of October, for want of a better word, I mean, I don't know if any of you disagree with me, but it's pretty dire.
It's a hideous failure, isn't it?
It is. It's awful. You know, we've got all of these troops, and this is where, like, obviously we all know, well, some, you know, of my love for the North Midland Division, but the South Midland Division are involved at the Battle of Polkapel, and also they're in Battle of Brunsdinder as well. And it is just an awful, awful, you know, words can't
be. It's that shortening of, it's the desire to try and achieve that breakthrough. They've shortened the kind of operational tempo, haven't they? They're trying to go quicker and quicker each time, without the kind of necessary regard for the conditions, which have got way, way worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not just a simple fact that, okay, it's raining, so it's difficult for the infantry to run through the mud. It is. That's a really, really big problem. But, you know, so much of what you've built your attack on is the artillery, isn't it? What is stabilizing a gun platform in that kind of conditions is nigh impossible. They're actually hitting a target on any kind of range. No, it's just not going to happen. So your artillery is less. Oh, plus everything's just muddy, isn't it? So every time you get a shell up to a gun, you've got to clean it. So it just reduces your rate of fire, and everything just works against you.
And it's continuing on from that. It's a different kind of mud, isn't it? We all know that mud. You know, if you have been on a rainy, horrible, stormy, wet day in the Ypres salient, it is just a different kind of mud than anything else.
You put your foot in it and you leave your shoe behind when you try and do it.
It's different. Yeah. It's different to the Somme mud, isn't it? Because the Somme mud will stick to it. So you put your boot in the ground on the Somme, and you get a layer of mud about 3 inches thick around your boot. And then you put your next foot in, you get a three layer of mud around that. And then you put your boot down again, and now you've got 6 inches of mud around your boot. But it's different in Ypres because it's sloppy, and you'll sink it. It's like sandy, sloppy stuff.
I'm just gonna read you an account. It's one of my old Etonians. He's with the Household Battalion up round Polkapel, and he's quite vivid with his writing. And basically, they get given their orders right at the last minute, and he says 24 items to be read, digested, and explained to the men before dark, and no one allowed to stand up, only run from one hole to another. There's no trenches here, they're all cowering in wet shell holes. And he says shell fire was taking its toll. While he was called to a conference, he was in a mud-smothered pillbox crammed with a dozen or so officers, and they were told that their objective was a cluster of German defences known as Rickett Farm. They rounded off affairs and then became uncomfortable wooden partings with people saying things like, good luck, old chap, and take care of yourself, and the very best of luck. And they, as cheerful as they tried to be, they knew they would never again stand in the same room as a complete group. And then he says, then began the most awful night I remember. It was pitch dark, impossible to distinguish any landmark, and no one knew the ground, and such ground. It is quite impossible to describe the shell holes, craters, and such being beyond belief, dreadful. So he's really religious. And throughout this nightmare spell, he just basically said, I sat there and I prayed, trying to calm himself down into some kind of acceptance that he's got to try and carry out this obscene thing the next day. The journey to the assembly point was a disaster. They were struggling along in a downpour when a shell landed right in the middle of them and wounded nearly half a dozen, including the stretcher bearers. And he just says, it seemed that the acme of hell on earth had come. No stretcher bearers, 10 wounded men in the wet, groaning for help. The company all mixed up. Oh, the rain. We tried to dish the rum and water out to these frozen, soaked, tired men. Meanwhile, I was trying to get other men to carry the worst of the wounded who could not walk. One poor man, I remember, kept yelling for help, and I could not do anything until the stretchers came back, and it was doubtful if they ever would. It's like, this is what the conditions are like in this battle.
I feel like that you, what you've just read is, if you said to someone, what do you think the conditions were like in the First World War, that is what I think most people would have as their image. You know, it's just this complete level of what the hell is going on, and just the poor conditions that are happening at that time. It's just a complete shit show, as Alex would call it.
There's no other word for it, is there? So this utterly fails on the 9th of October, and yet 3 days later they decide, and this is where Passchendaele comes into play, and this is where your poor New Zealanders get absolutely hammered.
My poor New Zealanders, like, they go halfway, literally all the way around the world to die in a muddy field in Belgium. You know, it's not just the New Zealanders who are fighting on the 12th of October. It is the first battle of Passchendaele, as we're now officially into Battle of Passchendaele. It's fine. We're there. We don't need to keep saying 30.
Breathe, Holmes, breathe.
Breathe. We're allowed to move on now. And it's not just not just New Zealanders, as much as I would like to think that it is. We have, as we say, you know, you've got a lot of actually very similar divisions fighting still. Again, you know, we've got like the 49th West Riding Division. They'd been in the area as well. They had also fought at the Battle of Polkapel. You know, so they are troops that are well adjusted to the what's been going on, but not necessarily well prepared for it. You know, who would be prepared?
New Zealand, a quote about what they thought when they arrived.
Yeah, if you've got one.
Yeah, so I'm just being ultimately lazy and just pulling stuff from all the books. What I wrote.
Yeah.
So this is from the Passchendaele book we did, and this is when they arrived. One of them says, so I put, you can only stare in shock and disgust at the panorama unfolding before them. And he said, ridge after ridge, the wilderness stretched back. All the beautiful woods were dead, and the skeletons of trees stood gaunt and stark against the skyline. The villages were heaps of filthy rubble. The gentle streams that had meandered through smiling valleys were flattened into horrible bogs and slimy quagmires. The green fields where the poppies had grown redly in the summertime were a wide expanse of dull and dreary brown. For mile after mile, shell hole touched shell hole, with there, here and there, a great gaping crater torn by a mine explosion. One could hardly follow the old line of German trenches, so ploughed and torn was all the earth. Line after line, their pillboxes crowned every height, swept every slope, enfiladed every approach.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's incomprehensible, really, isn't it? But this main attack, obviously, as I said, there are other units there, but the New Zealanders are, with the 3rd Australian Division as well, they are the main... get back to the thrusting. They are the main thrust of the attack on the 12th of October. Part of the problem is that they have problems before they even start. You know, we've talked about the artillery not being able to move forward and provide the support. You know, I haven't got the numbers immediately to hand, but there's the numbers of how many of the guns they've got for Polygon Wood versus then when you've got how many they've got for Broodzinder, and then the first Battle of Passchendaele, and the numbers are decreasing because they can't bring the amount forward to provide the support. So they're already on the back foot without the level of artillery support they were expecting. There'd been a slight miscommunication between the 9th and the 12th as well, where it was believed that the attack on the 9th had gone further than it actually had. So rather than being about 1,500 yards away from their first line objective, they were 2,500 yards away from their first line objective. So they're having to encounter another 1,000 yards of this territory before they need to get where they're supposed to be, their red line, their first objective. They are, from the off, it's the sort of almost what you would say, you know, stereotypical ideas of the First World War. You know, the barbed wire isn't cut, so they can't get through. So they get stuck in the masses of barbed wire. We have got these really intensely fortified German positions. As we said, you know, anyone who's seen any, you know, you've got your pillboxes, your dugouts, your concrete bunkers. They are heavily fortified machine guns with their enfilading fire crossing across each other, across no man's land, and making it an absolute killing zone. There's many stories, but Alex does have one in her book of Second Lieutenant Arthur Talbot of the 2nd Canterbury Regiment, who at this time is 41 years old. He had been a teacher in a town called Temuka, which is 85 miles south of Christchurch on the South Island of New Zealand. He left behind as his job as a teacher. His younger brother had already been killed at Gallipoli as well. So not a family, and he was quite well known as well in New Zealand at the time. He was an explorer and a climber, so he was actually relatively well known as well. And they just, as Alex puts in her book, you know, as she, you put it quite well, so I'll have to say it. So the New Zealanders had been tasked with overwhelming objectives over ground that was unfamiliar to them. You know, they find themselves caught in essentially a trap. There are tiny, tiny gaps when they can get through. They're tiny, tiny gaps where they're funneled into each area. Lockie, stop it. Some of us like to be teachers' pets.
Just for those who do not have the benefit of the video, Lockie's holding up a sign that says creep at Beth now.
He wasn't exposing himself this time.
Yeah. Much louder. But you're right. It sounds like I was having a rant at that point in the book. And this does make me want to rant.
Yeah. And he's just one of these men, you know, as well. He's leading his troops. They are trying to do what's expected of them up to eventually their objective was the Gravenstaffel Spur. I can never get that out properly. And that's
because it's got a random small S before it, hasn't it?
I ignore that. I can't deal with the S's and G's together. No,
Flemish place names.
Yeah,
I can't remember. Is he one of the ones that just vanishes?
Yeah, he is. He's like so many of them. They just disappear, you know, in this mess of an advance. And you know, we know why, as we've said, the positions had to be improved. We know why they needed to, but this one particularly seems very futile. And as you said, it is the worst day for the New Zealand division. You know, they are, there's particular stories, you know, of, you know, there's on the far left, you've got the 3rd Rifle Brigade, who are completely halted by machine gun fire and don't move anywhere much beyond their first line trenches. You've got on the right, the 2nd Brigade, that they come up against this barbed wire that was sloped obliquely against the New Zealand front. A few managed to get through, as we all say, you know, they quickly killed the ones that did get through, were stuck in shell holes. Any success where there was any was limited. They tried to keep pushing through. So obviously this is happening throughout the day. There's another push at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, but it was cancelled just beforehand. Eventually they ended up back where they started. Badly wounded troops were left lying in the mud. They couldn't be retrieved. Because this is then where the casualty numbers come in, and it talks about the worst day for New Zealand being this 12th of October. On that day of the 12th of October, 2,700 casualties registered to that day. They include about 950 who were either killed or mortally wounded. 843 of those are listed as actually dying on the 12th itself, and the rest have then succumbed to their wounds further down the evacuation line or in the days and weeks that followed. It's one of these watershed moments for countries, you know. We all know about
Bimini Ridge and...
Yeah, it's... Like,
on the Western Front, it is at least. We talked about, so they don't get Passchendaele, do they, Beth? They don't get anything through it. And if you want to go and pay your respects to the people like Arthur Talbot, who just vanished into the mud and were never seen or heard from again, there's a reason that New Zealand has its own apse on the Tynecott Memorial. It has a whole little section all to itself because there are so many names to put on it. So you can go and pay your respects to him and others there. But we then move on to, I mean, so they try again. They give it a couple of weeks and they try again. And so we've talked about New Zealand, and I just want to talk about Canada for the next little bit. We're almost at the end, people, don't worry. But yes, it does go on this long and it is this horrible, and it's not about to get any better. One thing we really wanted to do for the book was highlight again Canada, a young country, was to highlight the diverse makeup of the Canadian forces. They weren't all born and bred Canadian. So we did one story, didn't we, Holmes, for the 49th Canadian Infantry at the Second Battle of Passchendaele, which starts on the 26th, I think, of October, where they decide to have another go, because why wouldn't you when you've you've come this far already, why not kill some more people? This battle, this end of this battle makes me really, like, really angry. So we picked three guys in the same battalion, and one was a Cree Indian or First Nation tribe member. One was British, and the last one was Japanese. And you're really going to hear me rant in a minute about what happens to him. So much like the New Zealanders, they arrive in this nightmare scenario and they get these objectives to go and take the village of Passchendaele and its environs at the end of the month. Shortly after 5:50 a.m. on the morning of their attack, flames everywhere, flashing guns, burning shells. And the line on which they're assembled, including our three guys, which is Alex Decato is the Cree chap, Charles Sorden is the English chap, and Yasaku Kubadera is our Japanese chap. So the three of them are lined up with the rest of the battalion. Almost straight away, the machine gunners are put out of action. Their assembly line comes under heavy shell fire. And nonetheless, they all go sprawling out of these hastily constructed, I say trenches, but do not be thinking of the big organized things that you see in museums and that. Think of an absolute nightmare of just hastily scratched in positions. Alex Decato is one of the first to vanish. Nobody really knows what happened to him throughout the course of the day, because obviously he doesn't leave any account. But before the morning's over, he's hit by a sniper. So there's enemy snipers lurking in pits and shell holes trying to pick off the depleted battalion, which is getting nowhere near its objectives. And he was originally, they buried him sort of 1,500 yards west of Passchendaele with four of his countrymen in an unmarked grave. They did find his body after the war, and he was identified by his name disc. And he's now in Passchendaele New British Cemetery. But I think more importantly for him and his beliefs, since a proper Cree burial did not occur, in 1985, his relatives and friends performed a special ceremony that took his spirit home to Edmonton. And to,
so I guess, Alex, the other thing to mention about Decato, seeing as where we are at the moment, he was in the 1912 Olympics in Stockholm when he came sixth in something like the 5,000 metres.
I think it was either fifth or sixth, and he had breathing difficulties, didn't he, during the race? So he was one of the top athletes down the western coast of the Americas, but he didn't have a good day in the final at Stockholm, which meant that he didn't get the medal that everybody expected him to, I think, did he? That's what I remember from it.
Sixth he came.
Yeah. But he was an excellent, world-class middle distance runner. So I moved on to Charles Sorden in the book, who's 34, originally from Bridlington, but in 1910 he'd got, so a large number of his family all decided. He took his wife, his widowed mother, several of his siblings and all of their families, all decided to go and start a new life in Canada. Since then, he decided to completely start a new life and divorced his wife as well. But he had a family and he too is involved in this as well. So we talked about the mud. It rained overnight before the Canadians went forward on this attempt on Passchendaele. And so added to a deluge in an already deluged land, there couldn't fill their rifles, it was too cold and wet, they can't move, they're trying to skirt round all of the shell holes and past their, another one of these streams, the Ravabeek, struggling up towards higher levels. And somewhere along the way, Charles gets sucked down into the mud. And we've talked, didn't we, about how it was like clay and you couldn't get out of it. And he absolutely could not get out of it. So he had to laboriously attempt to dig himself out with his bare hands until he could drag his body back out into the open. This is before their advance ground to a halt. A medical officer with an NCO and a stretcher team came forward to establish an advance aid post, and he refused to go there. Instead, he began frantically dragging out all the other men that had become bogged down in the mud while still under fire. When he finally extricated someone who was still alive, he slung the man across his back and carried him to the nearest dressing station. He was nominated for a military medal for that day. That sounds rather more like VC winning to me, but that's not what he got from. And then Kubadera, right? This is where I get on my high horse, because a massive number of Japanese people had emigrated to Western Canada before the First World War, and he was one of them. And so you get a lot of Japanese people fighting in British uniform for the Canadians in the First World War. And this chap was one of them. So he's actually born near Mount Fuji, sort of southeast of Tokyo. And he'd gone and he joined this 49th Battalion, found himself in the swamp-like conditions. And again, got sucked down into the mud and couldn't move anywhere. So you think these guys aren't even fighting the Germans on this day. They're just fighting to survive the conditions. He digs himself out. Then he absolutely refuses to go back for medical aid, picks up his rifle and goes rushing forward again. Because he wants to get at the enemy, apparently. Determined, showing remarkable aggression, he ignored the heavy machine gun fire and rifle fire being levelled at surviving members of the 49th and blazed away with his rifle, showing a splendid example to all ranks of fortitude and devotion to duty. For his actions on 30th October, he was awarded the military medal. Needless to say, the Canadians do not capture Passchendaele on the 28th of October. They actually capture it at the beginning of November, which we won't go into massive detail on because we have rapidly outrun the time available to us and are probably boring everybody by now. But just to tell you what happened to him in later life, in December 1941, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. More than 23,000 people of Japanese origin were living in Canada by this point, and more than three quarters of them were Canadian citizens, including Yasaku Kubadera. This counted for little when concerns began to gain momentum about spies and sabotage. So the Canadians rounded up the Japanese people and said that persons of Japanese racial origin were to be removed from a 100-mile restricted zone in British Columbia and away from the coast. So that it put, despite his service in the Great War, he's put in a concentration camp. Hang on, let me get this right. 965 Japanese Canadians were sent to inland to Kaslo, which is where he's sent. And he and his wife, Chikai, were among them. Within 6 months, he had fallen ill and he died almost 25 years to the day after Passchendaele of pneumonia, interned as an enemy of Canada. His wife barely outlived him. His daughter was not allowed to inherit any of his property or his business. So actually, when we looked into it, following the surrender of Japan in 1945, they were still forbidden returning to the West Coast. Instead, they were given a choice of relocating east of the Rockies or moving to Japan. In 1949, the government finally allowed people of Japanese origin to move freely within Canada and reinstated their right to vote. In 1988, they formally acknowledged the country's mistreatment of Japanese Canadians during and after the Second World War and granted compensation to survivors. And then I just rounded this off in this book, and we'll round off with this just because we've already talked about how we took Passchendaele in the end. But Japanese Canadian soldiers fought on the Somme, at Vimy Ridge, Passchendaele, and up and down the Western Front during the Great War. 55 men of the original Canadian Japanese Volunteer Corps did not return home. 13 of them, including Kubadera, were awarded gallantry medals. A roll of honour had been produced in the aftermath of the war. When forced to leave British Columbia in 1942, one old soldier got that roll of honour out and he kept it on him for 25 years until the centenary of the arrival of the first Japanese immigrant was celebrated in Vancouver in 1977. And then he finally brought it home to where it belonged. And he said, a descendant of samurai, Corporal Kubota considered returning the roll of honor to be his final obligation to his comrades. He died the following year. Before doing so, he penned a poem for those who fell, and translated from Japanese, it reads, although you are gone, you are not dead. Surely the setting sun will rise again for you. Your heroic spirit will live in our hearts. We take the torch from your hand to fight and carry on. So by the time the Battle of Passchendaele rolls down at the end of November / beginning of December, Lockie, they've kind of got some of the positions that they want, haven't they? But they haven't finished the war. They haven't ended the war at all. And it's all, and this is like, you know, if you've seen U571, where you watch the whole film and then the credits roll and it says, by the way, none of this was really done the way it was in this film and the Royal Navy did it all. It's kind of like that for Passchendaele, isn't it? So we've just told you this massive long, over an hour long story, just to tell you that in a few months' time, we just give up all of this ground of our own free will at the beginning of
18. It's actually much worse than you think as well. Yeah. Because could it get any worse than this? Yes, it can. Because in October, Russia goes into revolution and pulls out of the war. And so hundreds of thousands of German soldiers are going to be moving west to fight the British and French. Can it get any worse? Yes, it can, actually, because Italian Second Army was utterly obliterated at Caporetto in October.
Pluma's going to Italy now.
Yeah, absolutely. And so just at the time that the Germans are going to be getting much stronger on the Western Front, Britain and France have to send divisions out to Italy to prop the Italian army up. It's a moment of utter black, bleak misery and the absolute rock bottom of morale for Britain in particular. I mean, the French are sort of picking themselves together again, but yeah. For the British Army, it could hardly be worse, because you've done everything, you've thrown everything at it and the kitchen sink, and you've not achieved your aims. And you've got, so it's
a quarter of a million British casualties, 70,000 dead.
It's something like that, and maybe the kind of the one thing to say about it is I don't think the German casualties were any smaller, if at all. And actually, you know, Germany could very ill afford, you know, another horrible mauling like they had on the Somme. So it's no picnic.
It's not even over. German army. Yeah, Cambrai still to come.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, well,
we haven't mentioned that the reason this does plod on for so long is to detract attention from the fact that we're plotting a big tank attack, which we can't do up here because of the ground further south. That's one of the justifications for why this carries on so long, isn't it?
Yeah, but even then, you know, Cambrai works, and then it doesn't, does it? Yeah. It's the German counterattack, which you know, Haig and the others didn't think that they had in them at that stage. They thought they were too badly mauled to launch a counterattack like they did. But sure enough, they did, and captured not only a lot of ground that had been gained in the initial assault at Cambrai, but quite a lot of those big metal boxes that we like, you know, the ones with the tracks, what are they called?
I don't know, Gareth goes on about them a lot.
I remember.
Yeah.
I suppose the frustrating thing for me for this one, I mean, it's a hard one to try and... They have the bit... Well, the first bit I can sort of see, and that might have worked, and it works a little bit. And then I think the most frustrating thing is they get to the second part, and they've nailed it. They've got it. They make all this preparation, and they know what works and what doesn't. And then they choose to ignore it. They knew that in the circumstances for the third part, you know, they weren't the same. So the successes they had in the second part couldn't be mirrored. Yet they still chose to go on with it.
Yeah. So you just make Pluma do everything that screwed it up in the first place. We've got
I think there's an element of kind of what happened in the previous year as well, because what happened at the end of the Somme offensive is Rawlinson had said, look, the conditions are really, really bad. We need to stop, otherwise we're gonna blow ourselves out trying to, you know, nurdle ourselves up a little bit of a ridge line to try and improve things. And so they did. They kind of stopped Fourth Army operations after October was bloody horrible on the Somme, and then had to kind of sit down at the bottom of the ridgeline. So in January and February, after being in a rubbish position all through the winter, and that was really, really bad as well, I can understand the desire to not want to go through that again. So I do kind of see it, but also, you know, the losses that, you know, in particular the Canadian Corps go through, when ideally you'd be wanting to use them offensively in the new year. Yeah, it's tough to justify.
Oh, John Terrain made a point in an article I was reading at the weekend, and it sounded more like he was just raising the point rather than a point that he believed in. But he did make the point that actually the Germans were quite worried by the end of this. They'd lost a lot of men. And he makes the point that, you know, if it wasn't for this ill-fated assault, you know, and they hadn't lost these men, if they had all these extra men who could take part in the spring offensives in 1918, would that have had a different outcome? Now, as I say, he only sort of seemingly makes that point rather than says that's what he believes. But, you know, it's something I'd not thought about before, and it did make me think a little bit.
Attritional warfare is not good.
But sadly, this for me is, I find the second half of this battle probably harder than any other point of the war to wrap my head around in terms of the decisions made. I don't know what you think.
I think that's a fair assessment.
No, you can certainly understand at least Haig's argument, kind of the idea, the desire to take the whole ridgeline so that you can press on early in the next year. But all the kind of other factors, you know, revolution in Russia, all those extra Germans coming over, you know, things in Italy going on, all of a sudden just take that away from them completely. There's no prospect of an early push on in 1918.
No. I mean, because we're not exaggerating about Italy. They look done in November 17. They look done.
So the more pragmatic thing to have done would have been to withdraw to Pilcombe Ridge, maybe, which they did in April 1918 anyway.
Yeah. So when the German offensive, when the Germans do bring all those troops across and throw them at us in spring 18, we have to tactically take the decision to give up all of this ground that's been fought for and everything we just talked about.
Yeah, I quite like the fact that it comes the day after Haig's backs to the wall, no withdrawal order as well. Yeah, the very next day, it's okay, yeah, we're going to pull off the Passchendaele Ridge now. Yeah,
but for 12 hours, unless you're in Belgium, some brackets.
No, 12 hours is why I've got a mug with that on it.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Guys, thank you very much. I hope we've given you all something to think about. Probably, I don't know about you, I feel like I need a drink now.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.